Yeah, and then when did you decide to write a novel?
Huh.
Okay, I have to confess that I recognized parts of your novel from Tina Kuyugan's anthology, Forbidden Fruit, the one with the papaya on the cover.
Yeah.
The first anthology of erotica written by women from the Philippines. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and actually, my novel grew out of two stories in A Normal Life, my book of short stories.
Yes.
Because I had stories, two or three stories there, because parang I changed the name of the characters, but it was the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty clear that it was the same story. And I just kind of got obsessed with those characters. It was just an obsession. I don't know. I just kept writing and writing.
How did these characters come to you? Were they based on people you know, or?
It's hard to say. Like, sometimes I start with a physical look of people I know, or some defining trait, but then it completely changes into something else in the writing. It's not a roman à clé, even though there are historical characters, you know, that can easily be recognized. But the main characters, Lali, Pilar, Arturo, the triangle, they're composite, I would say. But they're certainly not based just on one character. And then some people who know me well, or who think they know me well, which is not the same thing, say that the two women characters are actually two very different sides of me.
That's the thing. That's what stops a lot of people from writing, because everyone will just assume that you are the protagonist of your book.
But then you divide them into two protagonists.
Yes.
And then it's harder for people. Yeah. And then I get really interested in people's stories, and I get really interested in the gap between the social selves that we present, not just to others but to ourselves.
Yes.
You know, between that and then all the messiness inside, between what people really want or what people do, or how people's needs, like needing to fall in love or needing security, needing this or that, can just tear apart a lot of those nice little selves that we try to contain. And things like shame, like a man wanting power, wanting position in the world, and then feeling that he's not getting what he needs, that he's been shamed, and needing to fight back, or a woman getting crazily attracted to somebody who's absolutely the wrong man. And not only absolutely the wrong man for her, but happens to be her sister's husband. And then what do you do? You know, so much of society is built on holding back passions.
Yes.
Rightfully so. But those passions break through. That's why there are so many limits put on them, because they do break through and they do create chaos.
Yeah, there's a tsunami in the underground river.
In the river.
Yeah. So let's describe to our audience what the book is about. Because, you know, when people look at books, they're like, what's it about? You know, why am I interested in this?
Okay. Well, it's set in the period after
this is how
martial law.
I would totally sell it. It's got sex in it.
I was going to say, that's the first thing. In fact, I was with friends yesterday who had read the book, and they said, Bonnie, it's all sex.
It's a rare Filipino novel that is so frank about sex, because everyone is being
It's sex.
Cover your face with a fan.
It's sex, but it's not graphic sex. Mm-hmm. Even though people seem
it's
to
sexy.
Think people seem to think there's a lot of sex scenes.
Yes.
But I don't name those body parts.
Yeah.
Because it's not focused on the act. But
yeah, and also,
sex.
When you start describing the body parts, that is the way to laughter.
Yeah, and that's the ick factor, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the ick factor. So it has a lot to do about sex, because I think sex is one of the most unruly things that mess up so much of our social selves and our social lives, and that sudden passion between people. I also think that not enough is written about women's sexuality. And I wanted, like, how a woman feels. Because sometimes I feel like it's so parang rainbow-colored or so rose-colored that, you know, wow, it's romantic. But, you know, sex can be, like, painful. It can be messy.
Exactly.
It can be, like, I wish the guy would come already so that I can just go to sleep, you know. And then there's also the overwhelming need for somebody, and that thing of like you see a man's skin or you feel a man's skin or you smell him and something just happens to you that's stronger than you, that makes you, you know. So there are all these layers that I wanted to write about also. Also how women play on their sexuality, and I think people have pointed that out.
Because this is a topic that is largely unexplored, and please do not even mention 50 Shades of Grey.
No, it's not. Yeah. But how women play on their sexuality, and so do men, huh? But I'm talking here just about women. How you play on that sexuality, but it also is what
how
makes you
so... weaponize it.
How you weaponize it.
Yes.
And it's another thing of power, but it's also extremely... It makes you extremely vulnerable at the same time. So I find all of that very, very... very interesting. And so the book is really basically an exploration of like the love and sexual desire between two sisters and one man, and how they work that out among themselves.
Yeah, this is during the post-EDSA period.
It's
set in Manila.
Yeah.
It begins in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It moves on to Manila.
It's in a way, it's a reimagining of the Ninoy Aquino assassination. Just in the beginning, it's absolutely not Ninoy Aquino. Mm-hmm. But there's a Filipino dissident living in exile in San Francisco, as many dissidents ended up in different parts of the world. There were many in San Francisco who has two daughters.
Yeah.
And one of the daughters falls in love with the godson of whom I call the dictator,
the dictator,
or the general, who is clearly the Marcos figure.
Yeah.
But I don't name him as Marcos. So they're from different political camps, but like they're kind of from the same background. And yet the father has fought the dictator all his life. And this man is completely part of the system, benefiting from all the corruption and the contracts and everything. Mm-hmm. And the daughter marries that young man. And the father is assassinated. And they go back to Manila. And the other sister, Pilar, cannot forgive Lali for having completely betrayed her father and just selling out so she can have her nice life in one of the Makati villages and married to this politician who is, you know, charming but completely immoral and just wants to make money. And he is also in a vulnerable position because the dictator is gone. And he's considered one of the tutas. And he didn't go away. He's still here.
And he decides to run for public office.
And he wants to make his way. He also comes from that social class where everybody kind of forgives each other very, very easily. And so Pilar really hates her brother-in-law. And not hates, but, you know, has no respect for him and her sister. Problem is, they start to get attracted because the guy's not just bad. Arturo is also charming and good. And that's another thing in the book, that people are very complicated. I'm not making them black and white. They're not, they don't just have like a narrative structural role in the book. I tried to get that. You know, the compromises people make, their desires, their wanting, how important sex is, how important sexual wanting is. And we do not speak about it.
Yes, we don't.
We really do not. Mm-hmm. You know, in France, too, which is more liberal, you do not. You say, why did your marriage break apart? Well, you know, because we don't have the same kind of values, or because we didn't have much to talk about. People
when
will not
they should
say,
just say that it's because the sex was
it's
lousy.
Because they don't say they don't say because like wow, sex is really bad, or because like you know we don't like to touch each other anymore.
It is a very basic issue.
It's such a big issue, and there's one point also after one of the many sex scenes where, you know, Arturo tells this to one of the sisters, I won't say which one, and says that, you know, that actually the biggest, that's one of the biggest taboos, is that the way society is constructed is that you fall in love, you want somebody, you live with them, you have kids, you have a marriage, you spend years and years and years and years in proximity, and very often what happens is that you don't want to touch this person anymore because this person is too close to you, you know. And a lot of desire is gap. A lot of desire is distance and absence and not having. That's what really, really stokes desire.
Which reminds me, it always creeps me out when I meet married couples, fairly young married couples, and they call each other mommy and daddy. I was like, ew.
But, you know, I guess it depends on what people need, you know, because there's a comfort to be, I suppose there's a comfort to be I suppose.
Yes, because we did not speak from experience.
Yeah, in a long, happy marriage. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. I can imagine that's wonderful. But it's not... Yeah, there are trade-offs many times. I'm not saying all the time, but there are trade-offs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes passion and domesticity are not quite compatible.
Right, and I remember when
on
I
the
was
long
a
term,
kid, you mentioned
yeah.
fairy tales earlier. I remember mm-hmm. when I was a kid being bothered and says, it always ends with, and they lived happily ever after. And my reaction was,
diba?
Are you sure?
Yeah, that's the thing. No, that's really the thing. Mm-hmm. So that was...
Because I think that's... that is where the story really begins.
That's where it begins. And so the book is a lot about that. People needing passion, but also people loving. It's not just about sexual desire. It's also loving and how that collides.
Yes.
Loving somebody and desiring them. Having passion and loving. And what will prevail, you know? And the search for security, which is can
yes,
be
which
a,
is,
all these competing
in,
needs.
Which is why
yeah.
Lali...
That's
one
what
of the
she
reasons
does.
Why
yeah.
Lali does what she does.
Yeah, yes. It's one of the things. It's one of the reasons. One thing that helped me too in as the book became a monster because I just wrote. I had no idea what I was
like
writing.
How many drafts did you do?
I don't know. Like, but the thing was mainly was that it was over 1,000 pages long, and mm-hmm. it didn't. I just kept writing and writing. I thought the story would just appear. You know,
yeah,
I kept
yeah.
telling mga stories.
Yeah,
I
you,
had
you,
the
you
characters.
Didn't work with an outline.
No, mm-hmm. no. So the outline came after, mm. and I'll never do that again because I lost 20 years. But they were enjoyable years, I have
yes.
to say, at least in terms of the writing. And one of the things that really helped clarify was, and I should have done this before. Was really clarify the narrative arc for each of the characters, mm. the three main characters. And one of the main things was, of course, one of the basic things is you describe what the character wants.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basic. What the character wants, what stops them from getting what they want, and how do those wants collide with those, mm. you know, around them.
Yeah,
so
that's a good outline, as in you list down all your characters. What do they want?
Yeah.
What stops them from getting it? How do they intend to get it?
Yeah. And how that collides
yes.
with the wants of the
your
others.
Conflicts
yeah.
with other people.
Yeah, so that's...
Yes.
So I was working in one draft, I was working on that level. The advantage, just a side thing, the advantage of not having an outline was that because it was a mess, a lot of themes came out that I would not necessarily have chosen, like women's very ambivalent relationship to motherhood, mm-hmm. to having a children as being a mother and being a sexual being at the same time.
Yeah.
A lot of issues were coming out that in the mess mm-hmm. became interesting on the whole. But then going back to the thing of the drop, so okay, what do they want? Narrative arc, what stops them? But then... In another draft, I said, okay, what do they want? I've tracked this through. But what do they need? What do they need and how is that different from what they want?
Very
because,
interesting.
Because,
wants versus needs.
Yeah, because the want is the outer goal.
Yes.
It's the conscious goal. You know, Lali wants security. Arturo wants to get, you know, he wants to get elected, blah, blah, blah. But... What is their need? Because it's the need that's going to mess you up. If what you want and what you need is not aligned,
yeah.
and it rarely is, that's what takes you on all kinds of, you know, that can sabotage what you're trying to do. But it's also a very, very interesting thing to track because in the end, I think people would really go after what they need.
Yeah.
Without knowing it, you know. So that was...
Yeah,
that was
as in people lead lives where they're completely unaware of what drives them. Yeah,
well, of course. Thank
yeah.
God.
because they wouldn't...
Drives
they wouldn't
me.
Want... They wouldn't like
yeah.
themselves
yeah.
if they knew.
Yeah. Like Pilar, for example, she wants to carry on her father's fight. She
yes.
wants to be this upright.
So she becomes the archivist
yeah,
of this memory.
So
yeah,
so she wants to keep that. That's what she wants. She wants to be honorable in that. But what does she need? Is she needs to feel connected to somebody else. She needs to feel, to go away from her mind and to feel, to have maybe not a passion in the way that Lali needs passion, but she needs to love. She needs to feel connected.
Yeah.
She needs to be in her body. She needs to feel pleasure in her body,
yes.
which she doesn't, you know, she hasn't known that. And when that comes into her life, it creates an explosion because she's not aware of that.
Also, I think one of the factors is she doesn't really know other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, you know, her life is very constricted. Yeah.
And willfully so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at what point did you realize, oh, this is the home stretch and my novel is about to finish? Because a lot of people will write, will work on a manuscript until they die. So they'll just keep rewriting and rewriting and rewriting.
Yeah, I think I would have, but I think it was Margaret Atwood. I'm not sure if it was Margaret Atwood or somebody else who said, you know, I don't finish a novel, I abandon it.
Ah.
And I feel like that's what happened with me. I felt like I can't anymore. You just reach a point, I said, like, my God. And, like, I was so embarrassed to my daughters because my daughters were, like, all their lives they had seen me working on something. And I was thinking, if I die and I don't, again, the question of shame, which I think is the defining thing, I was thinking, oh, my God, how embarrassing naman. You know? It's like this mother who never did it.
I remember reading a book in which the writer just keeps going and going and going, and then it ends with, I think I'll stop now.
Yeah.
Because that's how I feel about a lot of the things that I write. I think I'll stop now.
Yeah.
Although, in my case, because I wrote a lot of columns, it's like, oh, it's 1,000 words. Goodbye.
Then stop, that's, and then when I did have the final scene in mind. I mean, the kind of the climactic scene in mind. I at some point I knew I was working towards that, so that was very helpful to know that I'm bringing it to this scene. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the visual scene, so that was helpful. But what it would take, where the characters would be when they reach that scene, I wasn't so sure yet. I didn't know what the relationships between them would be. And then I did the ending, and when I did then for me it was done, and I showed it to my older daughter, Kasia, and who's a big reader, and who's very honest and direct and outspoken, so I knew she'd tell me
she's
exactly
what
she
terrifying.
Thinks. Yeah, she's brilliant, brilliant and lucid and a reader, and like, you know, spares no words. And she loved the book, and she hated the end, and she said, Mom, you cannot do that to your readers. You cannot put an ending like that. It was like you just wanted to end the book. And she said it was untrue. It was untrue. And I think you as a writer, you know what it means when we say we try to be true. It has nothing to do with historical truth
it has nothing
or whatever.
To do with facts.
But we know when we're writing true,
yes.
And we know when we're writing just to get it done, which is valid for many types of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're trying to write true, you're writing from a different place. And she was absolutely right. I was trying to finish the book.
So you went back.
And I just tried to write true. It was basically the same ending. Right? It wasn't like the ending changed that much. But I wrote it from a different place and a different voice and a different point of view. And I put other things in. And then she approved it. So
you know, that's exactly the kind of reader all writers need.
We
someone
need it, no?
Ruthless and unforgiving.
And you know what? Preferably not somebody doing the same type of writing you
exactly.
do. And maybe somebody who's a reader rather than a writer also.
Right.
Sometimes that helps. Huh?
Yes.
Somebody who just reads books and just reads and reads and reads and will complain about the characters and the story and this and the pacing.
Yeah, so the reader that you need, someone who...
Yeah, somebody who...
is in the habit of reading a lot of books, because as I was saying, readers who only read a specific genre, they tend to get too attached to the character. It's like, I don't like this guy because he's bad. So, but that doesn't mean that he is not valid as a character.
Yeah.
As in, they start looking at them as human beings that they'd like to hang out with. That's it. You know, these characters are not your friends.
Yeah.
Nor do they want to be your friends.
Yet a character, bad or, you know, bad, whatever, in quotation marks, also has to pull you in.
Yes.
You know, because when I read, I want to be pulled in by
the
character.
It's an unfortunate fact of life that the bad characters are
really interesting.
They're, of course they are, because they're complex, mm-hmm. you know.
And also yeah. they do things that we wish we could do.
Yeah. They take, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's, yeah, I mean, definitely.
They're not stopped by.
That was the fun part of writing Lali, that character, because she just goes for it, yes. you know. And she goes for things.
And that's
so,
part of the fun yeah. of writing. It's
yeah,
like,
you can yeah. let them. You can let them go places. I remember also when I was young, I read this story. Again, I'm really bad with titles, by Somerset Maugham.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he was going to, in the beginning of the story, it was part of the story, he said he was going to do something extremely difficult and was to write a story about a good person.
And
that
yes.
was probably going to be like no story and quite boring. And to be honest, it was quite boring.
Yes.
Because it's very hard to write, you know, to write characters mm-hmm. that way.
Yeah.
I know now, as I plan for another book, and I have an idea for another book, I don't know if it will happen. I definitely do not want to do what I did with this, because I don't have time in my life for that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put limits, uh-huh. limits in the book. I
so
want
you're going to start with an outline.
I'll start with some kind of outline, but I think that I'm also going to put limits in terms of the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kind of delimit it in terms of where it starts, where it ends,
mm-hmm.
just so, which is a kind of outline, and then, you know, put the key points in between and see if I can work that way. But you never know until you actually start doing it, like, you know.
Will it still be set in the Philippines, or?
I don't think so. And I have two ideas for books. One is set in the Philippines, and it's a bit my mother's story,
mm-hmm.
and because I've grew up with the most wonderful, well, some of them are horrible, but I grew up with very strong stories about Negros from the time of my grandmother, great-grandmother.
Yeah, I know that story.
Yeah,
like,
I have wonderful
which is
stories.
Like, what is that? La Lupa.
Yeah, I yes. have incredible
by Giovanni
stories.
Verga, yes.
Mm-hmm. Incredible stories. Like, and I feel like how sayang not to do anything with that. But maybe I can just write like a little list of stories for my daughters. And the other story is exploring more this man-woman thing, how men and women are together. And not a big-scale book like this one, which covers, you know, quite a... It covers like
it's
social,
kind of a,
political,
it's a, it's
sexual...
sort of a personal yeah. historical epic.
Oh, yeah.
So
a smaller-scale book between a man and a woman and a kind of sexual game between them, sexual... erotic... more erotic than
yeah.
sexual game that goes wrong. And I have this idea. And it would be a small book, which would be a relief to me because I'm so scared of dying again and not having finished something. So I will see. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'll see with that. The other book naman, like I said, is set in the Philippines. And I have to say, like, one of the things that stops me from making that actually into a work of fiction is I'm so tired of people saying, but why do you write about the Philippines if you're not Filipina?
Mm.
You know? That kind of questioning. And I feel like, you know, it's
yeah,
my story.
It cultural appropriation.
But you know,
oh,
it's my story.
Yeah.
It's like my mother's story, my grandmother, my great-grandmother. That's my story.
Yes.
You know? It happens here. Because there are people of different colors
mm-hmm.
in this country, even though it's not the majority by far,
yeah.
but there are. I asked some of my classmates from Assumption who look really very Caucasian like me, and I say, what do you do abroad? Because actually here people don't ask it so much.
Are you kidding?
Here when
here
you start to
like,
speak Tagalog.
I feel like telling people, put down that skin whitener.
Yeah, yeah. But here also once I start speaking in Tagalog, you know, right away, there's a shift. In the
yeah.
beginning, it's like, oh, ma'am.
Ah, marunong ka naman
yung Tagalog. You know. Mm-hmm. So I ask the friends abroad, like, what do you say? Do you say, what do you say you are? Because, you know, I know they feel like me, you know.
Yeah.
You can't say you're Spanish because, you know, 400, 500 years ago, there was, you know. And they say, one of them told me, she said, I say I'm Filipina. And then if they say you don't look Filipina, I just say, well, that's your problem. She
good
was like
approach.
So down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then she's not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
She's not writing about it or, you know, she's not exposing herself to that kind of, you know.
Well, so, but I think The Betrayed is one of the most enjoyable recent fictional works.
Oh, thank you. I love that word.
on the market, and everyone should read it. And also, I think it should be a movie, or more appropriately, a miniseries. Because with a movie, you're going to have to cut out a lot of things, to fit into the 2-hour mark.
Yeah.
But
I also have to say, like, one of the things that made me finish the book was Karina.
Karina Velasco
of Ateneo University Press, because she kind of put her foot down.
She says, turn it in now.
Yeah,
it's like our teachers used to say, finished or not finished,
your paper. So I'm very grateful to her for, like, believing in the book, and as I am to many writer friends, including you, and, you know, people who really, really gave me courage.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I want to do with this podcast is to get people to pick up a book and read. So we're talking about, you know, a lot of erotic fiction, and then we've mentioned Jean Rice. So they recommend some authors that, you know, authors you have read, you know, people that... James Salter.
Oh, yeah, James Salter.
Yeah, James Salter writes the best sex scenes.
Yeah. He's really, really very good. A Sport and a Pastime.
Yes.
That's the one. I know you like Light Years, no?
A Sport and a Pastime I recommend to everyone, and my description is always, well, it's basically driving and boinking.
it is. But it's interestingly done because, again, we talk of the levels of desire.
Yes.
And in A Sport and a Pastime, it's basically that.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is the narrator wasn't even there.
He wasn't there.
For the things that he was describing.
The narrator is describing how he imagines his male friend making love continually everywhere in every position to this French girl who the narrator is in love with. So he is imagining all this incredible sex between two people.
Yeah, so it's quite possible that these things did not happen. But then this is a novel.
It's a novel.
It's not supposed to be something that happens.
Yeah, it's a novel. I have a hard time with erotic literature, personally, again, where there's a lot of very, very graphic sex because of what we call, like, this ick factor.
Yeah, and then you become eligible for the bad sex.
The bad sex award. And, in fact, I once taught a class on writing about sex and desire.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my master's thesis on Marguerite Duras. And how she writes about desire.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did that was, you know, obviously it's a topic that interests me, and it's very much woman's desire. You can't say, unlike Anaïs Nin, for example, who I think writes a man's idea of a woman's sex.
Yes.
You know, she's
catering to
that.
But then, you know, she was writing for a buck a page.
Exactly.
For a collector,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly. Whereas I think Marguerite Duras really goes to it, you know, from a woman, from the inside as a woman. And when I reread her novels for my thesis, I realized that they seemed to me like the most erotic novels, but there was no graphic description.
Mm.
There's no real... And that's when I started to think, wow, how does this happen? How does it happen that something can be so erotically charged and you think that you read about sex, but there's actually, you know...
No body parts.
No body parts, but she talks about what happens before, what happens after, what happens in the room, you know. One of the most erotic things, I think, in the North China Lover is a man's finger. And not entering any body part either.
Yes,
just the hand, you know.
Wait, what's the difference between the Lover and the North China Lover?
The North China Lover is kind of the same story as The Lover, but she wanted to tell more closer to the truth of what had happened. So it was a step less fiction. I mean, it's complicated.
So it's sort of a rewrite.
Yeah. The Lover was a fictionalized thing of what happened to her with this young man.
Which was made into a terrible movie.
A very, very bad movie. And because of too much graphic without enough of the eroticism.
Yeah.
And North China Lover, which I actually prefer, is her retelling more based on what really, you know, she remembered. But being Marguerite Duras, it's mixed with a lot of things. So I found that very interesting in writing about sex and desire. And the other thing that helped me was Italo Calvino, his Ooh. Essays on the new millennium, six essays on the new millennium. Mm-hmm. But he only wrote five because then he died. And he has an essay called On Lightness.
And, on Lightness,
and
yes.
In On Lightness, he says that when he started writing, he wanted to write political realism, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem was when he was writing about the heavy problems of the world, his writing became as heavy as the subjects. Like his writing turned to stone. It was like unreadable. Mm-hmm. So his idea was, how can you write about these topics, heavy topics, while keeping lightness in your writing so that people can actually read it? Because if it's so bigot, it's so heavy, it's so depressing, people will turn it
away. Good point. And so he said, I think I'll write about a baron who decides to live in the tree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So
his mission accomplished.
Yes. And his image in the book, and this was the image, was that when Perseus tries to slay Medea, mm-hmm. if he looked at her in the face...
Medusa,
sorry, yeah. Not Medea.
I'm thinking of another... Medea.
I'm thinking of Leila Slimani's book and The Perfect right. Nanny.
Yes.
Slaying the babies. Yeah. If he looked at her straight in the face, he mm-hmm. would turn to stone,
yes.
so he couldn't slay her.
Right.
So to be able to slay her, he looked at her image on his shield, the reflection on the shield. So you look away in order to slay. You look away in order to strike. Mm-hmm. So he said, like, writing about violence, writing about these kinds of things, you can write it slant. You can say, like, what's going on all around without describing the actual thing, and the emotion will come through to the reader.
Good advice.
Like, there's a violent scene in the novel that I won't mention, and when I first tried to write the scene, I tried to describe the act of violence.
In a kind of journalistic reportage.
Yeah.
Way. Yeah.
And I couldn't do it on several levels because I had never witnessed it. And second, that I felt was appropriation. I felt like trying to describe the real horror when I had not been there. Somehow, you know, you can't just do research on this and then paste it. So I tried to describe the faces of the people watching it. I tried to describe what was going on, you know, around. And I think it worked. And I think I did the same for sex in the book. I wrote mm-hmm. around it. I looked at Perseus' shield.
That is an excellent point. Because I was just trying to explain to a friend why the thing he had written was more of an essay than a short story. I think because essay is more a reportage.
Yeah.
It's the thing itself.
Yeah.
And a short story will kind of write around it.
Yes.
It will look
that
at it obliquely.
Right. Yeah,
yes.
That's right. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
Yeah.
So those are, yeah, so...
Yeah, so are you planning any readings or book signings for... Because you've only had one event so far, which is the one in... Oh, you've had two events.
I had two.
You had the launch at Ateneo, and then you were at the...
I was at
SOAS.
Yes. Yeah, where I was asked by Christina Wan, and it was wonderful, to launch and to do a reading. And this was following a workshop that with... Gina Apostol that
yes.
had given at SOAS.
The author of Insurrecto.
Insurrecto,
yes.
which is wonderful, and wonderful to meet Gina finally after
yeah,
having
Gina's
heard,
badass.
After
yes.
you know, hearing about her. So that was a very, very interesting event, and I enjoyed that.
So
yeah.
Before we close, did the audience members ask you any questions that you never expected? Like, what a strange question to ask me.
They were very good questions. It was a very, very, very smart, very interesting crowd and a number of very good writers in the crowd, which is always a pleasure. One of the questions that really made me think was I was asked why I didn't name Marcos.
Ah.
Why I didn't name the dictator as Marcos. Why
yes.
did I sidestep
yeah.
that? Especially mm-hmm. at a time in the country's politics where we need to name, we need to remember, we
mm-hmm.
need to say what people
right.
you know, had done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really a question that made me think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no easy answer. I understand the point, and it's a troubling question. At the same time, personally, I had, in an earlier draft, it was named Marcos.
Yeah.
But again, we're speaking of writing true.
Yes.
And sometimes... Fiction, I'm not writing a historical novel. If I named him Marcos, I would have to stick to the facts.
Mm-hmm.
in a way that right. would have not been true
yeah.
in terms of the atrocities and the problems and all of that.
Correct.
Because it is fiction. It is fiction. And so those were the choices I made, because I needed the freedom. I needed the freedom to reinvent so as to make the fiction stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
So that was, I don't know if it was the right decision, but the guy's not Marcos. He's a conglomerate of different kinds of dictatorial personalities
yes.
that can rule this country.
Yeah, it's kind of like Autumn of the Patriarch, or, you know, yeah. those novels where uh-huh. they do not name the
yeah.
the specific
yeah.
Historical basis yeah. for the character.
At yes. the time, I didn't even name the Philippines in Manila.
Ah.
I took that out also. But then I put it back in because that was too odd not mm. to have the name of the place. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, last question: when can we expect the next book?
pressure.
Before I die, so I don't know. I'm hoping, given the constraints I'm putting in myself in terms of the shape and the style of this book, because I don't want it to take so long. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping 2 or 3 years. I'm hoping.
Cool. Yes.
I'm hoping. But you know. You know.
Yeah, so thanks very much for doing
Thank
the podcast.
You. Thank you.
And don't forget to get The Betrayed from the Ateneo University Press.
They Shopee.
Actually have, yeah, Shopee or Lazada. And there's actually a small store inside Ateneo if you happen to be in
yeah.
Quezon City.
And it's also in quite a number of national bookstores around the country.
Yeah, and fully booked.
Fully booked. Yes. Power Books, I think. I'm not sure. But yeah. So... Thank
yes,
you
so
much,
and
Jessica.
Also watch out for the movie or TV series, which I think should happen.
Written by Jessica.